It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A survey by Pew Research Center finds that Americans think tipping is expected in more places these days, but the rules and the etiquette about how and when to tip, that's unclear. As we discuss tipping culture, be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Courtney Norris is an assistant professor of hospitality and tourism management at Oklahoma State University. Courtney, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so Pew finds people who have worked tip jobs in their lifetime, they're more likely to leave a tip themselves. What do you make of that? How does working in a tip job encourage people to tip more?
Yeah, that's a pretty common result in a lot of the research that I've seen as well. And I would say it's, shared experiences. Mm-hmm. We know what it's like to have worked in those types of jobs and how grueling and how difficult it can be. And so you kind of pay it forward. And I found that in my own research as well, when people were saying, I asked people the same question, like, do you tip more? And they're like, oh, absolutely. You got to pay it forward. They say generally they'll tip people who've been servers or bartenders previously in their life, they'll tip about 25%. And if it's bad, they'll still even tip 20%.
With inflation, rising prices, should people be leaving higher tips?
I think yes, but maybe not in as many places as currently are asking for tips on their digital screens.
What is going on with those digital screens? Like, how has this proliferation of cashless payment methods affected tipping?
I think it's made it so much easier to just add that screen at any kind of checkout because it's an option. And because these digital payment systems have those capabilities, they're like, okay, cool. Let's add that to the screen. Why not? And, you know, I asked some of my friends, I'm like, what's the craziest place you've seen tip requests? And they said the gas station and their esthetician's office and random places where you would normally have never seen that tip line before are just popping up. And I think it's just because of this proliferation of these digital payment systems, more than I think anything, it's become an option. So why not add it?
Okay. So, Courtney, like, just lay it on here. How rude is it to select no tip when the employee is right there in front of you?
I mean, I feel the same kind of, you know, social pressure or the, you know, having to comply with social norms of tipping. However, I think the biggest question to ask yourself in those situations is, you know, how much is that person actually making? And the people at like Starbucks or like counter service places, right? Starbucks, Panera, those places, they're all making generally the federal minimum wage or more. The difference is that food servers in sit down style restaurants or bartenders in those restaurants are only making, in most states, every state kind of has a different rule, but most states they're making $2.13 an hour and are expecting tips to kind of bring them up to the standard $7.25 minimum federal minimum wage.
And the floor here in Wisconsin is $2.33 an hour, the minimum wage for tipped employees. So, you know, if the expectation of tipping rises, how could that affect what employees pay in base wages?
I'm sorry.
If you see more tipping, then what does that do for employers who are paying those base wages?
I mean, and more than anything, it increases their revenue. And I think the second question to ask when you see those digital tip payment amounts in places where you normally wouldn't see them is who is getting that tip? Because in some cases, the employees may not be getting those. They could be going to managers. They could be going to store revenues. And so that may be presented as a tip, but that doesn't mean that the employee who's standing right in front of you is actually making that money.
We're talking about tipping and tip culture. Courtney Norris with us, assistant professor of hospitality and tourism management at Oklahoma State University. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mark in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I'm a worker that kind of my wages are supplemented by tips. I'm a tour guide in Milwaukee, and I think, it's a service that we actually provide. And, some people are concerned about, well, when do I tip? Well, I think if a service is directly provided to you and somebody's going, above and beyond, they should receive a tip. But, when they hand the food over the counter to you, and they say, well, now do you want to do a 25% tip? People are a little leery about that.
So you feel like after a great tour guide, that
Experience.
is an appropriate time at that departure to be able to reflect on how that experience has been. Is that what I'm hearing, Mark?
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Courtney, what do you think about that timing? I mean, if tipping is an indication of the experience or the performance, how are you to decide, what to tip when that experience is just being handed to you in that moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, tour guides definitely, make an experience. And food servers and bartenders and cab drivers even are similar, that it's about the experience that you have when you're there. And so, tipping that's commensurate with what you feel is, appropriate. You could use, how much did the tour cost and do a percentage based on that, or just, a flat rate. $10, $20, your tour guide went above and beyond. You want to shower them with some appreciation for that extra effort, then you go a little bit more. But I think we really have to look at the experience that's been given to us and what that meant to us, and assign a dollar value, which isn't always the easiest thing to do. So it's easier to look at a total amount and add a percentage to it, generally, like you would do in a restaurant.
Mark, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Bonnie in Brookfield. Bonnie, hi. What is your perception here?
Hi. So I was a waitress, and I usually went above and beyond. If I get a poor server, doesn't do their job, doesn't check on us, rude, I will not tip them 20%. I will tip them accordingly. If they are a superb server, I will tip them what they deserve. And I will also tip in cash, so I know there's no confusion about who's going to get that money. But I will not feel guilty, having been part of the service industry, tipping what they deserve based on their performance.
Bonnie, how do you feel about tipping before or after tax?
I feel like it's a horse apiece. It's not going to make a huge difference.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm not going to scrutinize it.
Courtney, what do you think of Bonnie's approach?
Yeah, I think she's right. Before, after research, tax, it doesn't really make a huge amount of difference. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of servers, former servers out there who say, you know what? You didn't do your job very well, and you don't deserve to be compensated for it. And others, the other group who will just tip 20% no matter what, are just wanting to, they understand that maybe it was a bad day. Maybe they, had a bad customer before them. It's so situational in serving tables and who you're interacting with and how that affects your mood. And so, they generally will just say, hey, it may have been an off day, and they'll give 20% anyway.
Courtney Norris studies tipping behavior as an assistant professor in the School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at Oklahoma State University. Call in with a question. You can add comments along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. how are tipping expectations changing? We're in conversation with a hospitality researcher who studies the nature of tipping, and we explore your tendencies towards service workers. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Courtney Norris is here, assistant professor in the School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at Oklahoma State University. Courtney, Pew Research says about 30% of people who haven't worked in tip jobs say it's not at all easy to tell when to leave a tip. Where should people be leaving tips?
That's a great question. And most definitely, tips should be left for food servers in sit-down restaurants and bartenders as well. Places like Starbucks or Panera that have counter service where they're simply taking an order and giving you food. Yes, absolutely. They're providing a service, but it is not the same level of service. And I think that that's the big differentiator, is the level of service being provided. And, you know, maybe a dollar or two to your counter worker if you feel so inclined. But I don't feel that, you know, the pressure to comply with social norms and as far as tipping goes in those situations should drive people to tip in those situations. You know, those counter workers are making a decent wage, at least the federal minimum in some places more. But your servers and bartenders are definitely not making that same minimum wage.
We've been hearing echoes of 20% in this conversation. Is 20% applicable to most services? When should you go lower or higher?
I would say 18 to 20 in any kind of a sit-down restaurant setting. More should the server go above and beyond and provide maybe personalized service or, you know, get you a special item that's off the menu or anything along those lines in other situations. You know, I don't think that percentage applies. I think that the original, you know, 15 to 20% that we started with, you know, a long time ago was in relation to sit down restaurants, places like, you know, getting a ride share or a counter service or to go food. Even I don't think that going to that 20% as a standard should be what we look at. Maybe just a couple dollars instead of a percentage.
Let's bring in Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Some of the largest tips I've ever left were above and beyond servers trying to make a badly cooked meal correct. Please, everybody, remember, don't blame the server if the cook messed it up.
Kevin, thank you for that. You know, Courtney, Kevin pointing that out in terms of the kitchen staff. What do you make of that?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the times when people are tipping in a restaurant, they consider maybe food quality as a portion of that tip. However, as Kevin mentioned, the server has nothing to do with the quality of food coming out of the kitchen. I mean, they can act as a gatekeeper and say, I'm not sending that to my table. You should redo it. But they're not making that food, and so they shouldn't be held accountable for that. And, you know, the kitchen staff makes their own hourly wage that is not at the sub-minimum wage level. So, you know, in some cases, there's a wage disparity in the restaurants. And so that can be another kind of aspect of it. But, you know, when you're giving a server 20%, that server isn't keeping that full amount of money. They're tipping out the hostess, maybe the busser, maybe a food runner. They're also tipping out the bartender for whatever drinks were made. And so by the time they're done tipping out all the people who have facilitated the guest experience, they're maybe left with 17% of that, maybe less.
And is it common now at all for tips to be shared with the back of the house, for, you know, tips to be shared with the people who aren't, you know, seen by the customer?
There is, there was some tip pooling legislation that came through saying, you know, if you're pooling tips, then it should be split with everybody who is involved in the guest experience. However, most restaurants have yet to actually do anything about that. I think it was actually overturned because the servers generally feel that that's unfair. And and the research, there's some research that has shown that they prefer not to work in tip pooling situations that include tipping out the back of house.
When a restaurant has a no tipping policy, how do you, as a customer, express your gratitude or your appreciation?
That's a great question. Other than a verbal, you know, thank you, and maybe, you know, if you felt the need, you could leave a little bit of extra money. But in those cases where there's service charges, they're generally getting paid a higher hourly wage, and so they don't need the tip money to bring them up to a certain level of a minimum wage. But, you know, a little bit always sweetens the pot and makes you feel special.
Nancy in Milwaukee called in and says tipping shouldn't be an expectation and that they believe restaurant owners should be paying fair wages to employees and that there should be more pushback from the public on the expectations of tipping. Do you see any of that movement, Courtney?
Yes, I think that's a great point. The food service sector is the only industry where employees' wages are paid partly by customers. And so I think that's a little bit antiquated. It also leaves that obligation to customers, which, you know, if the server is bad and the food is bad, then you absolutely shouldn't leave money. I mean, you've worked hard for that money. And if you didn't have a good experience, then it shouldn't be rewarded in any way. But the other thing is about tipping and that culture is there's a lot of negative outcomes associated with tipping for servers. And, you know, eliminating it would go a long way to eliminate some of those negative outcomes.
Courtney Norris with us, Assistant Professor of Hospitality and Tourism Management at Oklahoma State University. You can join the conversation. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tim in Juneau County called and wants to know what the tipping percentage should be for bartenders. Any insights?
Yeah, I think for your bartenders, you know, starting at 20% would be ideal. You know, a lot of people go $1 per drink or $2 per drink is a standard, and that can work too. But your bartender is also providing you, in a lot of cases, conversation, suggestions, information. Perhaps if you're visiting an area and you don't know anything about what's there, they'll provide you that information. And so that conversation and interaction is a little bit more than just making a drink. And so, you know, I would say 20% at a bar, unless, of course, it's terrible. And again, you know, if it is terrible, then not feeling obligated to tip.
The tech company Square says most restaurants automatically add tips to a bill with six or more people in the party. How helpful to servers is automatic gratuity?
It is a guarantee to them that that some of their effort will be rewarded, because there's always, when you go into a situation as a server or bartender, you may not get a tip. You could do all of this work and you could go above and beyond, and at the end of the day, those folks will still walk out and leave you $0. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's a lot easier in a big group to not get a tip because, you know, the expectation is, oh, somebody else left the tip. Oh, somebody else is taking care of it. And so you may get left with nothing. So the automatic gratuity at least ensures that that effort and that time really is not wasted in a, you know, zero income kind of situation. And yeah.
I hear risk there. What are the risks of working a tipped wage?
There's a lot of, I kind of mentioned earlier, negative outcomes. One of the biggest ones is sexual harassment. Because you're in a situation where that person is basically paying your income, it's almost like you have to put up with whatever mm-hmm. is being said or done in some situations. And, you know, in my own research for my dissertation, I asked that same question. I'm like, you know, have you been harassed? And they said, absolutely. I think 17 out of 20 interviews I conducted said they had been sexually harassed. And these are both men and women. And that, you know, you just have to accept it. You just have to laugh it off. You just have to forget it and move on, because you still have to make money and you still have to earn a wage. And those people pay your wages for the most part. And so that idea that you have to engage in those behaviors in order to make a living is really unfortunate.
In our final moments together, is tipping here to stay?
Unfortunately, I think it is, as much as I, you know, I worked for tips for a long time and I do appreciate them, but you know, there's so many other negative outcomes. Like I said, the sexual harassment, there's discrimination, there's wage theft on the part of the employer, and would be fixed if tipping were to go. Unfortunately, that would take a large scale social change that I don't think we're ready for.
Courtney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Courtney Norris is an assistant professor of hospitality and tourism management at Oklahoma State University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An airport in the Fox Valley is undergoing a major expansion. We learn about how the Appleton International Airport is changing to meet the needs of the region. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a Wisconsin couple falling in love.
Though Steve and Emily Lakatis met in their 30s, they both found out it's near impossible to escape the awkwardness of a first date. And though it didn't go as well as they hoped, the one who set them up had the feeling that sometimes you just need a second chance. The couple talked with one another about that experience as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Steve Lakatis, age 43.
And I'm Emily Lakatis. I'm 41. All right, well, you showed up and you just cleaned out your car. It looked very nice. And I looked at your eyes. You had a very long beard and very long hair at that time, and a ponytail at the back of your neck. But you had very kind-looking eyes. So I looked at you in the car, because we had never met each other. You picked me up, and that was the first time we met. And then you wanted to go to this Mexican restaurant in Hammond. What was it called again? That famous Mexican restaurant.
El Taco Real.
El Taco Real in Hammond, because you knew that from your childhood. So we went, and you had the worst stomach problems, and you wouldn't tell me what was wrong.
That's
and
true.
So I was like, what is going on with this guy? And he was like, kept going to the bathroom, and he wouldn't tell me what was on. So it was kind of weird and bizarre. And to compensate, I just kept talking and talking and talking, because I don't know, you were just being so weird. And So you thought you were not impressed, because you thought I was just this crazy chatterbox, and I was not impressed because I was like, what is with this guy? So actually, we didn't really go on a second date for quite a long time. But then I was at the clinic. The clinic where you worked was my vet clinic for the rescue I ran, Happy Tales. And so I was there at the clinic, and just you happened to be bringing out some kittens to come to the front desk as I was there bringing in an animal. And you kind of looked at me and you were like, oh, hi. And I still to this day don't know if you came out there on purpose or if Mickey or somebody sent you out there. When they saw that I was there.
Mickey sent me.
I think Mickey sent you. Okay, that's the first time you've ever admitted that.
She tricked me. I didn't know you were out there. She said, yeah. She said she needed me to bring something up there, and then I ran into you. Yeah.
Wow, she is good.
Yeah.
So she was the one, Mickey, who set us up the first time, and then she created this second. Anyway, you kind of looked at me and you were like, oh, yeah, hey, like, I remember you. And you said something, oh, I'll give you a call or something like that. And you actually did, like, you started texting me again, which I was kind of shocked about. And I remember telling Mickey after our first date, I was like, Mickey, I wasn't impressed.
Yeah, I believe that.
And but then I don't know why we gave you a shot. So was the second date, was that the Gary Railcats game?
I think it was, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, we went to the Gary Railcats game and we started talking and we were just having so much fun. We had good conversation. We both think we're quite clever, I think, is what it comes down to. And funny. So we went to the Railcats game and we kind of hit it off. And then we officially, I think, started kind of dating.
So we married on June 16th of 2020. We're parents of two, one of which our daughter was just born about 4 weeks ago at this point.
We can't believe all the twists and turns that have led us to come to this place with these children. It's miraculous, and I think we're both just in awe of it and really grateful.
And you know, I love you more all the time.
I love you.
Thanks, I love you,
Steve.
Too, Emily.
That was Steve and Emily Lakatis of Green Bay. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, as Appleton International Airport breaks ground on a $66 million expansion to more than double the size of the airport, we examine changing travel needs in Northeast Wisconsin and what is driving increased passenger traffic. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Abe Weber is Airport Director of the Appleton International Airport. Abe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Good morning, and thank you for having me on.
So why is this happening? Why is the airport doubling in size?
Well, the need for our expansion really comes from our growth and development. You know, outside of COVID, we've experienced double-digit passenger growth every single year going back to 2016. So it's really been the needs of the community that have pushed this project forward.
How is the community changing? Is it more business travel? Is it more vacation type travel? What are you seeing in the trend lines?
A little bit of both, quite honestly. You know, we have a very strong economy in the Fox Valley area. It's comprised of 23% manufacturing, and we think that really drives at business travel with salespersons, technicians, vendors coming in and out to do business. Plus, we've seen a significant increase in Allegiant elevating up to a base of operation here to really add new destinations for leisure travelers.
On a budget.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And nonstop at great low fares.
So expansion plans expected to be completed in phases. Some of the expansion scheduled to be completed in late 2025. What improvements can travelers expect?
So we're looking at really four main pillars to this concourse expansion project. Connecting our communities through universal design so that we want to ensure that every person feels welcome. We're really expanding our restroom facilities to make sure that we can accommodate elderly care, you know, gender diverse people that just need a quiet space. There's going to be quiet space in that restroom block. Whether it's meditation, prayer, people with autism that want to just relax for a moment. We're looking to inspire innovation through smart daylighting, mechanical systems, and some biophilic design so that people feel comfortable when they travel through Appleton Airport. We're looking at exceptional customer experience. That's, I feel, what has drawn people to use Appleton Airport more often. You know, larger and refreshed restrooms, as I've mentioned, but also expanded gate space, new and exciting concession programs, plus accessible, inclusive spaces to make sure that the best product is produced for our community. And the last is really environmental stewardship. We have overarching goals to be a better steward of our environment, and that's through material selection and construction practices that'll lower our carbon footprint.
Oh, what are you doing there? Can you talk a little bit about those innovations?
Yeah, so that goes really hand in hand with our sustainable master plan. Appleton Airport was, you know, one of 10 airports that was selected to go through a sustainable master plan back in 2012. And we've selected several different programs since then. And this project is going to fall in line with that master plan to make sure that when we do a project, we're looking at the small things, like mentioned, construction practices, material selection, looking at biophilic design to bring in plants and make the area more comfortable so that we're not adding to the carbon output.
So as you look at these plans, could travelers face higher fees to support funding the projects as the years go by?
So our goal was really to reach out with all of our partners at the Wisconsin Bureau of Aeronautics, the FAA, and then we've been building funds ourselves to make sure that we can pay for this project and not put, you know, the onus back on the airlines so that they would have to raise their fees. We're not looking at a significant cost increase to our airlines, and therefore we don't expect, you know, our airline fees to go up. We have, on the outset, very little control of the airline fees, but as we've added additional flights, aircraft have gotten larger, more seats have come into the market, we've actually seen our fees come down. So as we increase competition, we expect those fees to be more affordable for our travelers.
So you don't anticipate your gate use and terminal use fees will balloon after this remodel, because that could be passed on to passengers by way of higher ticket costs?
Absolutely. We've really been focused on that and keeping our, in the industry term we use is cost per enplanement down, to be very competitive to allow our airlines to expand and continue to grow here.
How might people using the airport be affected by expansion construction?
So we're really working to ensure that the customer experience doesn't change or adjust as we get into construction. You know, the new concourse expansion will essentially be built on its own. And when it's ready, we'll build a connector to the new concourse. So all of our gates will remain intact. The food options will remain intact. You know, regular use of the restroom and facilities will remain intact. So we're trying to have as little impact on the customers as possible.
In terms of restaurants and retail, what do you see happening there? Of course, I would imagine it's part of the plans, but do airports like yours see opportunity for growth there in that sector as people wait for their flights?
We do. And part of our project will be going out requesting proposals for interested vendors to submit and come in and do business here and offer both restaurant and gift shop services at the airport. You know, one of the things that we're bringing forth is the design of a beer garden to bring a little fun and hospitality back to, you know, the travel industry. And we think that that will be a big hit with our customers.
Abe Weber is Appleton International Airport's director as we discuss the work underway to expand the airport to meet the needs of the Fox Cities. Be part of the discussion. You can call in with a question, add your views at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Appleton International Airport officials say nearly 1 million passengers fly in and out of its airport each year. We learn about an expansion underway and the growth in air travel in the northeast part of the state. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Abe Weber is with us, director of the Appleton International Airport. Abe, the airport serving travelers on four airlines, American, Allegiant, Delta, and United, how could the expansion plan affect its flight offerings?
So our goal is always to work with our airline partners to look at new and exciting routes. We look at how we can improve the current route structure, whether it's a larger aircraft to our current hub or destination, whether it's more frequency to that destination, and then ultimately new route. And beyond that, we're working with, you know, other airlines outside of those four to take a look at Appleton and see if they want to expand here. So we've been very aggressive on that front over the last 10 years, and it's really paid off in the growth that we've seen.
And you are in the shadow of other airports, also, you know, Milwaukee Mitchell, less than 2 hours away. How do you view that type of competition and the surrounding airports?
Well, Milwaukee is definitely a large competitor of ours, as well as Chicago O'Hare. Hmm. You know, we lose a tremendous amount of traffic every single day to the road, people choosing to drive down 2 and 3 hours for a flight. And so what our staff have really focused on is how can we, you know, provide a faster, easier, more convenient experience in your hometown and keep those people from driving down the road.
And do you feel like that is something that you're able to get across to your prospective air travelers? Or do you find that people more and more are turning to the road and going to those larger airports, whether it's for the ticket price or the destination route?
Yeah, I think it's something that we've been really focused at, right? We've looked at the customer journey and, you know, myself and several of our staff have gone through lean training, and we've value stream mapped the customer journey, much like you would a manufacturing process. You know, how does the customer arrive at the airport? How do they park? How do they go through the ticket lobby and through the checkpoint and onto the restaurant and onto the gate? And we've broken it down into its pieces. We've looked at removing the waste in those steps. And when you put it back together, you do get a much faster, easier, and more convenient process. So we've brought innovation, we brought amenities that the customers enjoy to try to, you know, force them almost to say, boy, I have to fly to Appleton Airport because it's just a faster, easier, more convenient airport for me and my family. And I think we've had some success. We're not winning 100% of the customers, and I don't know that we ever will, but, you know, if we can win 50%, if we can win 60%, we're going to be able to continue to grow our airport.
As you grow your airport, people might be confused about the name with international in it. What functions do you have or offer at the airport to have international in the name?
So we have a user fee customs facility on site. That's something or the process we went through back in 2013, 2014, and then finally brought that facility online in 2015. And it allows aircraft with 20 passengers or less to be able to land here directly from an international port. And so while we don't have commercial air traffic arriving, it does mean quite a big deal for our general aviation activity as well as our tenants and outside users.
I wonder what's in a name to change from like a county regional type name to having international in the name of the airport.
Well, we went through that process back in 2015, and we went from Outagamie County Regional Airport to Appleton International Airport, and the customs facility was part of that. We had to adjust our name to provide the international nomenclature, but, you know, our county board and our county executive got together and understood, you know, that many people from outside of the community were using our airport and were calling it Appleton, you know, already. And so they did a name change study, and Appleton International Airport is what they chose.
Looking at some recent numbers here, more than half of pilots working today will hit the mandatory retirement age of 65 over the next 15 years. And younger pilots not making up those for those who are aging out. Do you think our pilot shortage is a concern amid your expansion plans?
I think the pilot shortage is a major concern, not only for our expansion, but for the industry as a whole. And that's been something that we feel has been coming for 10 years. I've been sitting in conferences and working groups looking at ideas to generate, you know, how can we adjust, you know, the processes and programs that pilots go through for training to make sure that, you know, it's more attractive for young individuals to get into that career field. And I don't think there's any kind of silver bullet that's going to solve it. But in essence, we're trying to do our part at Appleton by, you know, advocating young individuals to come into this career field, because I personally think it's an incredible career field. Travel and, you know, tourism, it's exciting, it's fun, it take you anywhere in the world. And I think on the back end, it can provide a really good paying job for many individuals.
We're discussing expansion plans underway for Appleton International Airport. Abe Weber supervises airport operations. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Here on the show, we discussed drone detection systems this year and their ability to protect airports from malicious drones. And I want to listen to Mary Lou Smulders here of San Francisco-based drone company D-Drone talking about how the technology informs the air traffic control tower of a threat.
If a drone pops into the airspace, they'll be immediately notified with the location of the drone, including altitude, as well as the location of the pilot.
Does the Appleton International Airport abuse drone tracking technology to prevent aerial threats?
We have not gotten to that point yet. It's something that our staff is studying and reviewing, but we're just not there yet.
With the expansion plans underway, will there be any impact to air traffic control?
There shouldn't be. Prior to the concourse expansion, we had some refurbishment of our runways and taxiway structure that took place in 2022. And so our airfield is in very good shape.
Are the airport's expansion plans in our final minute to pick together, could they affect traffic congestion or noise levels for nearby residents?
They really shouldn't. We're not changing any of our traffic patterns, you know, and we're going to see the same, if not a little more traffic, but they're falling underneath our standard arrival routes. So it shouldn't have any real impact on noise levels or the local community.
And your days and weeks ahead, first phase of construction, when is it expected to begin at the airport?
So the construction has commenced. There's a lot of site preparatory work. The safety plan has been in place, and we're just starting to excavate to get into footings and foundations. So we'll be in that work for the next couple of months.
Well, Abe, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate the update.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Happy construction.
Absolutely.
Abe Weber is Airport Director of the Appleton International Airport. If you missed part of our conversation, or any conversation for that matter, you can go to WPR.org/mornings. Download this one, stream it later on. That's WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.